Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, when you were in school, did you ever dissect earthworms?
No, but as a youngster, I would sit around with my friends and I would pluck them from the ground and then we would cut them in half.
Why?
I think the idea was that we would double our profits if we sold them to fishermen.
Oh.
I don't know that we actually ever did that.
It's like Land of a Million Lakes or something up there, right?
Something like that.
Yeah. So there were a lot of fishermen in the area.
There was a lot of fishing going on.
And they were dim-witted enough to buy halvesy worms from children.
I don't know that we actually sold them.
Okay.
But this was sort of our version of the lemonade stand that really never came to fruition. I think it was just about cutting them in half, to be quite honest.
Were you going like lengthwise or down the, like?
Oh, no, like not down the middle.
Okay.
Just across the body.
Because when we would cut them open, and certainly I grew up at times, in the countryside and on Kentucky Lake, so I have slain many a worm on a hook. Generally didn't catch anything, but I've engaged in that kind of barbaric behavior myself.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, I definitely remember dissecting them, where you had to, they give you the worm that's been drenched and preserved in fluid, and then you have to slit it down the middle and
mm-hmm.
then peel it back and pin its hide, and then go in there and pinpoint the different organisms. So when we were putting this episode together, I was looking at the drawings of the inside of
mm-hmm.
the earthworm, and it was bringing back memories. I'm like, oh, I remember that, and I also remember the harsh chemical stink of the whole thing.
That I do remember, but I may be associating it with frogs.
Oh, it's probably the same smell.
Yeah,
because they're both preserved in the same liquids.
But yeah, to see all that splayed out, you get to see the glorious entrails, the circulatory system, the respiratory system, and it's very cool to see all of that, or know that all of that is packed into this tiny little wriggling, slime-alicious tube emerging from the ground.
Yeah, so did you like worms? What was your relationship with them? You just enjoyed cutting them up?
I mean, I'm not going to say enjoyed, because I see what's going on here.
Okay.
You know, frying ants, cutting up worms.
No,
next thing you know, I'm a serial killer.
No. We've discussed before, a lot of this is just you testing your boundaries. Which living creatures can you cut in half and get away with it, and which ones can you not?
Look,
and we all have to find that thin gray line for ourselves.
Yeah, look, I had that sort of idealized upbringing, out in the Michigan countryside, playing with mud pies and tearing apart worms. That's all I can say about it.
Well, they tend to go hand in hand, because you're making the mud pies, you're getting the ground wet, worms are coming up. Next thing you know, this is happening.
And you're singing the Hearst song. Are you familiar with this? The worms come.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. They play pinochle on your snout.
Scalp, right?
Snout.
Snout?
Snout.
I always heard of scalp. Maybe it's an alternate version.
It's possible.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so if you haven't guessed, in this episode we are talking about earthworms. We're going to take you through the basic anatomy of the earthworm just to refresh your mind. If it's been a while since you've wormed a hook or cut one open in a classroom, then we're going to talk about some more interesting things regarding the earthworm, about its conquering of North America,
mm-hmm.
and also a little something called worm grunting that I was not familiar with until just the other week, and am in total amazement of.
And you wrote a great blog post about it with an accompanying YouTube clip, which is wonderful.
Yes, wonderful, wacky, and very British. So, the Brits out there already know what I'm talking about. But hang with us. We will get to that as well. Before we get into the anatomy of the earthworm, I do want to point out something and make a callback to a previous episode. The last common ancestor of earthworm and man existed about 600 million years ago. But if you just focus on the digestive system, we're not all that different. If you remember from our several part series where we went through the human anatomy, and we mentioned Mary Roach's book Gulp,
mm-hmm.
She has a point where she points out that humans are, quote, basically a highly evolved earthworm surrounding the intestinal tract. And so I think that's something that one of the reasons we find earthworms so fascinating and sometimes a little horrifying. And also, of course, why we cut them open in science classes, because it's a very simple model.
Mm-hmm.
That's very inhuman, but at its roots has a lot in common with us.
It's true. And I'm glad that you point that out because it really is sort of, we are sort of these glorified earthworms with heads and shoes on, right?
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about these earthworms. They are classified in the phylum Annelida or annelids. They are mauve-colored, as I said, slime-alicious tubes. They're found in Europe, North America, and Western Asia. You can spot them probably in your local garden. And they are used, of course, on fishing lines for bait. But their main occupation is as underground farmers.
Yes. Yeah, they're herbivores. They live up to 6 years. In size, you'll see them get up to 14 inches in length or 35 centimeters. Weight, if you choose to weigh such things, up to 0.39 ounces or 11.2 grams.
You know, I have read that there is a particular kind of earthworm in South America that can grow up to 8 feet long. We're talking about 2.4 meters and weigh over a pound.
You need a bigger hook for that, that's for sure. And, of course, their bodies are made up of ring-like segments called annuli, and these segments are covered in setae, or, you know, basically small bristles, mm-hmm. which the worm uses to move and burrow. If you ever saw the movie Tremors with the monster worm,
yeah.
which takes a lot of different aspects of biological peculiarity and combines them into one monster, mm-hmm. But they also point out that the monster in that moves through the ground or supposedly does in the same way that an earthworm does. So these little bristles, you know, frantically pulling it through the earth.
Yeah, because ultimately those segments have to move independently of the entire body, or else it probably would never get anywhere.
Yes.
And it's pretty slow moving as it is.
Yeah, and it should come as no surprise to anyone that on the front portion of the worm you have a mouth. On the final segment, you have an anus. And as they burrow through, they consume soil. They extract nutrients from decaying organic matter like leaves and roots. And in doing this, an earthworm can eat up to one-third its body weight in a single day.
Yep, and they also consume organic matter like dead animals.
Mm-hmm.
And in their gizzards, this is the place where everything kind of gets blended up, they actually consume some stones and some sand granules, which help to break down that matter. So I think that's pretty fascinating if you think about that. And then, of course, the result is something called castings. This is what comes out of the anus. And it contains a lot of nutrients that plants can use. And some people even use these earthworm castings as garden fertilizer.
Yeah, so they're very important to the soil. They transport soil nutrients and minerals from the surface, from below to the surface via the waste. And their tunnels actually aerate the soil as well. So.
Right, so they really enrich that soil. And I did want to point out that that earthworms kind of fall into a couple of groups in terms of where they live. Some of them live just above the ground, and they kind of squirm in or just below the plant litter. Now, these are all those leaves and twigs and bark
right.
that are on the forest floor. And those earthworms feed on leaves and the fungi and the bacteria, and they help to break all that down. And then some live higher up in trees. I did not know this, inside decaying wood or piles of plant material that gather between limbs. So if you are frightened of worms, just imagine taking a nice leisurely walk through the forest and looking up and knowing that they're dripping above your head. And then, of course, you have those that are traveling through the layers of soil, which is what we kind of think of when we think of earthworms. And then, as you said, those that burrow really deeply down and can burrow down as deep as 6 feet underground.
Cool. And another, just tell, you know, we're not going to spend too much time with the rest of the worm's anatomy, but there is that telltale little thick portion that looks like a larger segment and bulges a little bit, and that is the siltellum, and that is that has to do with the mating. And basically, what happens here is they're hermaphroditic,
mm-hmm.
much like our friends the slugs,
but they can't self fertilize. Right,
they cannot self fertilize, so they're not like truly. You know, asexual in that sense. Following a mating, a worm forms a tiny little cocoon out of a liquid secreted from the clitellum. The sperm and eggs are deposited inside this cocoon. It's buried, and about 2 to 4 weeks later, baby worms crawl out. So there you have it. The magic of life.
And they do their reproduction thing on the top of the soil, by the way. So
yes.
A lot of times earthworms are referred to as night crawlers because they come out at night to feed but also to reproduce.
Yes. All right. So you're probably saying, okay, well, we already knew all of that, Robert and Julie. That's just common worm sense right there. Let's get to the mind-blowing stuff.
Yeah. Enough about me trampling on them at night during their love mating times. I know that.
Barefoot?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, okay.
What did the Earth look like before these guys were widespread? How have they changed the soil of our Earth?
Yeah, I mean, specifically North America. At least North America provides a really good example mm-hmm. of this. This is explored in greater detail in Charles C. Mann's two books. The first one is 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, and 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. You can also find an article about this titled America Found and Lost, where he goes specifically into some of what we're talking about here today. Basically, the idea here is that you can more or less attribute earthworms in North America to a single dude. And that dude is John Rolfe,
mm-hmm.
who is also generally most well known as the dude who married Pocahontas.
Right.
Yeah. And this is all taking place around Jamestown. Jamestown was founded in 1607, and it was just a bad place overall. Foul place. Bad water, mosquitoes, eventually malaria, famine, people eating all their livestock up, digging up their own dead, one case of a man allegedly killing his pregnant wife and salting her meat, mm-hmm. Tension with the local Powhatan tribespeople. It was a pretty bad bad little corner of history there. But more to the point, there were no earthworms at the time. The hardwood forests of New England and the upper Midwest have no native earthworms. They were apparently all wiped out in the last ice age.
Yeah, like 11,000 years ago.
Yeah. So you were talking about the earthworms eating up all the leaf litter.
Uh-huh.
Well, if there are no earthworms to eat up the leaf litter ends up just piling up.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a rather different ecosystem. But then what happens? You have colonists coming over like Rolfe, and what are they bringing? They're bringing everything. They're bringing their agricultural lifestyles with them. They're bringing their
plants.
Domesticated animals, their plants.
Mm-hmm.
They're bringing tobacco plants that have earthworms in the root ball.
Mm-hmm.
And also, once they actually start successfully growing tobacco in the New World, they want to bring it back to market in Europe. So in order to keep the ship from riding too high in the waters, they have to weigh it down. What do mm-hmm. they weigh it down with? They weigh it down with shipments of earth, and
right.
that earth has earthworms in it. And so
when they get to the New World, they just dump that earth, right?
Yep.
So they can make room for the tobacco.
Exactly,
that
add its weight in tobacco. But then you have all this dirt and these worms introduced to this New World.
So what you're saying here is it's kind of like terraforming. Right?
Yeah, really. Mann does an excellent job just talking about just you know, how many factors are involved here. There's one wonderful little part here I'm going to read here where he really sums in not even specifically the worms or even Rolfe here, but just the overall movement of people and their things and how it changes the world. He says 250 million years ago, the world contained a single landmass known to scientists as Pangaea. Geologic forces broke this vast expanse into pieces, sundering Eurasia and the Americas. Over time, the two halves of the world developed widely different suites of plants and animals. Columbus's signal accomplishment was, in the phrase of historian Alfred Crosby, to re-knit the torn seams of Pangaea. So, the more you think about it, like he points out that a lot of these crops, a lot of these signature dishes that
mm-hmm.
we take for granted. You think about tomatoes in Italy. Well, it's because they moved there from somewhere else. They
mm-hmm.
were taken there by humans. Oranges in Florida, chocolates in Switzerland, and of course hot peppers in so many different culinary traditions. Like he points out Thai food. And this was something I remember reading about when traveled there years ago, is that all these signature hot, spicy Thai dishes.
Mm-hmm.
The Thai cuisine was a dramatically different thing before the Portuguese arrived and brought these alien species. And so that's what you have going on in North America. You have these alien humans bringing their alien species in an alien way of working the land and using it, and it just changes everything. And the earthworm is a huge part of that, because now the earthworm is just all over this huge segment of North America, and they're thriving. They're in no danger of disappearing.
That's true. They become invasive, right? And even though they're slow moving, it does take a couple hundred years before people begin to realize what sort of effect they're having, because
right.
they are spreading. They're getting a foothold. And a good example of this is the Chippewa National Forest, and this is in Minnesota. And they noticed that the landscape was really changing dramatically. And so those leaves, those twigs, the other plant debris, this is called duff. And as you had noted, the earthworms like to munch on that. Well, previous to the earthworms, this was really broken down by fungi, bacteria, mites, and it was a refuge for some small birds and animals. And it also helped that duff held in the moisture like a sponge for other plants. And those are like the middle growth plants of forest. So we're talking about wildflowers, shrubs, and then tree seedlings. So what happens when the humble earthworm is unleashed upon this landscape? Well, they begin to remove all of that duff. And so those tree seedlings, those other middle plantings no longer exist. And it changes that habitat for the other animals. And of course, the problem here is that they're spread even, it's not just, you know, oh, Columbus deposited a big pile of them in dirt, and then that was the end of the story. The story continues because fishermen use them as bait, so they're introduced into lakes and rivers and streams, and farmers use them in composting. So, of course, they're spread even more around lands that then begin to encroach upon hardwood forests.
Yeah, and the crazy thing, too, about earthworms is that unlike a lot of invasive species that are introduced, a lot of these species will they're introduced to an area, and then they'll continue the work themselves. They're more than happy to spread their numbers across the lands. But as Mann points out, earthworms, you introduce earthworms into, say, your backyard, if your backyard is for some reason earthworm-free, they'll thrive in that area, but they're not necessarily going to expand beyond your backyard. They're very local. So this is all on humans. This is all our, again, using them for bait, transplanting plants from one place to another, moving soil from one place to another, and eventually just creating a new nation under worm.
You know, that reminds me, too, of the Anthropocene episode that we did, and we talked about how humans have changed the landscape so drastically, and that we are so responsible more than any other natural phenomenon for moving massive amounts of dirt and earth all over the world. So if you think beyond just even fishermen or, gardeners or farmers using earthworms, you have to realize that any time that we take dump trucks full of soil and move them to one other place, then we're introducing earthworms as an invasive species.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because Mann also points out that, to no one's surprise, this sort of fantasy world idea of Pocahontas and the settlers doesn't match up with reality. We tend to think of this idea that they arrive in the New World and and everything is just this lush, Avatar-esque, untouched wilderness, and then there are a few Native Americans moving around almost unseen, just a seamless part of the environment. But as it turns out, the Powhatan tribespeople had already really done their part to change change the environment and keep it the way they liked it, such as using controlled burns to clear out some of that underbrush, and then constantly hunting and gathering too to collect the items that they depended on for their diets.
All right, so now we have an idea of these suckers as an invasive species.
Yeah, the conqueror worm.
The conquering worm. What about this worm grunting thing?
Well, you know, we should take a break. We'll take a break before we get to the worm grunting, but stay with
us
because when we come back, humans and non-humans alike will call to the worm and the worm shall rise up from the ground. All right, we're back, and we are talking about worm grunting, also known by a few other names. You may know the worm grunter as a worm charmer.
Mm-hmm.
You may know him or her as a worm fiddler. You may know this as worm snoring. But in Florida, at least, it's called worm grunting. And you can, in fact, find this pastime throughout the southeastern United States and even in the United Kingdom. Had you ever heard of worm grunting before?
I had not. But I think it's fascinating because what we're talking about here is driving a wooden stake into the ground and then taking a flat metal rod across the top of it and creating a sort of bullfrog-like grunting sound which emanates from this.
Kind of a noise.
Yeah.
And just you have to imagine the setting. Like here's this this woodsy Floridian going out into the wilderness there, pounding the stake home, and they're just sitting there. Moving the grunting stick back and forth. and then waiting for the worms to crawl up.
It's true. Like a minute or so later, depending on the sort of sound spectra that you create, yeah, these worms emerge from the ground and...
Oh, and it's a rooping iron, by the way, I should point out.
That's the
thing that they move across the state.
A roping iron?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's cool about this is that it's that sound spectra that's made that shares a similarity with burrowing moles we have found.
Yes, because for a lot of the worm grunters and the worm charmers elsewhere, they didn't necessarily understand the science of it, because
mm-hmm.
you don't really have to understand why the worms are crawling up. You realize that they're doing it, and then you want to get in on the action.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, two examples of worm grunters in nature that don't understand the science of what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
The wood turtle and some seagulls. Gulls and wood turtles also use worm grunting. The turtle especially is adorable doing this, because the turtle kind of does a little dance
mm-hmm.
on the ground and does the dance just right, and then the worms come up, and then he eats the worms. And likewise, the seagull does the same thing. But What is the reason for it, right? Well, the worm grunters of old might have maybe thought it was magic. There was one theory at one point that it was the idea that the grunting, the tapping or whatever kind of sounds you're making on the soil, that they somehow sound like raindrops falling,
mm-hmm.
and that the worms think, oh, the rain is coming, I need to get to higher ground so I don't drown in the earth.
Which, you know, we see this sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a good rainfall and then a couple worms appear. But
right.
This, it turns out, is not the actual reason why worms will rise to the top when you make these certain vibrations in the soil.
Yeah. And in 2008, biologist Ken Catania, he set out to look into this. So he went out, he did a full-on scientific investigation,
mm-hmm.
and he found that the reason is, like you said, moles. So the mole in earthworm lore, of course, is the worm gobbler par excellence. He is the greatest foe. He is the ultimate enemy of worms.
Yeah, no doubt. Like, he is the boogeyman in worm folklore. Like, they sit down with their worm kids and they're like, the awful mole is going to come visit us one day.
Yeah, and there's a lot of bad stuff that can happen to you if you are an earthworm.
Mm-hmm.
These things are plentiful, but they're also very nutritious. So, you know, birds will not hesitate to eat them. Fishermen will not hesitate to put them on a hook. Little Julies will not hesitate to slice them up for fun and possible profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming to the surface carries with it certain risks. But those risks do not even compare to the risk of staying underground when a mole is burrowing through the area. So worm grunting, using this stake and the special rod, or some of the worm charming techniques you see in England, they have the whole festivals for this every year. And if you look at the videos, it's just like a bunch of people going nuts, like hitting the ground with objects, playing musical instruments. So there are other ways to get the proper reverberations going in the earth. But the idea is that, again, it sounds like a mole. It's just enough crossover between mm-hmm. the frequencies to where the earthworm interprets that as a mole approaching. And so they take to the surface. And they will take to the surface in the hundreds. We're not talking like just one or two earthworms. We're talking about all the earthworms in the vicinity rising at once.
Yeah, and if you doubt this mole-earthworm link, just consider that a paper published in Biology Letters showed that recordings, just the mere recordings of worm grunting vibrations, bring worms to the surface, and that more worms will surface nearer to the source of the vibrations of where those recordings are being transmitted.
Yeah, Catania said that they found that worm grunting vibrations were more uniform and concentrated near the 80 hertz area, while
mm-hmm.
moles produce a wider range of vibrations that peak around 200 hertz. But there's just enough overlap between the two to make this practice a reality.
Yeah, and you have to think, too, like, why would people do this? Well, you know, they probably said, Look at that turtle over there just raising these worms like raising the dead. We could profit from this. We could do this. We could have a whole field of these and gather them and then sell them to fishermen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the main reason worm grunters do it. I mean, maybe it's kind of a power trip as well. You know, things aren't going right in your life, but at least you can go out into the woods and hundreds of worms will obey your every command. But, yeah, generally, I guess you box them up at that point and you can sell them to fishermen.
I wanted to point out that the festival in Florida takes place in Sopchoppy, Florida.
Ooh, that's a good Florida name right there.
Isn't it?
Sopchoppy.
I thought it was great for an earthworm festival.
Yeah. So I was amazed by this. I just hope everyone else finds this as fascinating as I do. Because I love any kind of like weird folk traditions that are just, you know, just seem to, at first glance, to just be completely mystical and strange. But then they end up having some sort of a hidden science to them. And I think worm grinding is a great example of that. Like I really want to see more of this in action. I kind of want to try it for myself.
Do you want to start a festival here in Georgia?
Well, I don't know if I'll go that far, but if there is an existing one, I would totally be up for checking it out.
All right.
Yeah.
If anybody,
worm fun and games for the whole family.
Yeah. If anybody there is organizing one, let us know in the Southeast.
Cool.
That would be fun.
All right. Well, I'm going to read a quick listener mail then. On that note, if the robot will bring me one. All right, this one comes to us from Brittany. Brittany writes in and says, an interesting tidbit to add to your information on sundials. I took a Latin class a couple of years ago and found out that ancient Romans divided the day, daylight day, not full day, into 12 segments based on the sundial. The length of the segment changed based on the time of the year, but everyone followed it, so it didn't matter. There you go. She's, of course, responding to our clocking in episode where we talked about the nature of time as well as how we measure it. All right, and this one comes to us from John. John says, hey, Robert and Julie, I saw this video and I just had to send it to you guys. It blew my mind just how much small things like the jar in this video can change our perspectives on the world and other people. I love your podcast and I hope you keep blowing my mind. And he sends this video of the statue experiment that took place on the High Line in New York. This is that people have probably seen it on like an episode of Louie or certainly some cool pictures of it where it's a elevated train track that they turn into a little park. And there's this statue there. And at first glance, it looks like a performance artist. You know, like the kind of people you see like in the streets of New Orleans who paint themselves like bright silver and then put on some shades and stand there and wait for tips. But then you quickly realize it's just a statue. Well, in this video experiment, they put a tip jar next to it. And everyone just starts loading the tip jar. They instantly, like that flips on the switch to where people decide, oh, I guess it is a person.
Right.
And then they are totally reacting to it differently. So I found that interesting. And certainly now that we're doing more videos, always open to receive some video links from people. And really cool, like little bits of viral video or scientific video that you would like to have explained. Because we do this series, Science on the Web, where we do that. We take something like a cat in a shark suit on a Roomba chasing a duck. And we say, hey, what's the possible science of this? And then we start talking about it. So if you have anything like that you would like to send to us, let us know. If you would like to talk to us about worms, your experience with earthworms, your experiences with worm grunting or worm charming or whatever you call your worm calling tradition in your part of the world, let us know about it. We would love to hear from you. You can find us, as always, at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is our central location, but we also have social media accounts on Facebook. We're on Tumblr. We're on Twitter, where our handle is Blow the Mind. And how else can they get in touch with us?
Well, you can always send an email, and you can do that at blowthemind@discovery.com. For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.